Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
They picked my grandmother, they stripped her, so she was just like a little baby, just skin and bone, and she was thrown onto the cart, wheeled outside, and thrown on the pile of corpses.
All our episodes are special to us, but I think this week's episode is particularly special, mainly because we got to hear from Tommy Reichenthal, who is a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possibly one of the most emotional episodes of the podcast, primarily because while we've talked to a lot of people who've lost several members of their family or their friends close to them, this is grief on a huge scale. Yeah. And it's grief from quite a few years ago that has only, it sounds, manifested itself now.
Well, this is the thing. So Tommy didn't speak about it for over 50 years. And then he decided that he wanted, how important it was to talk about his experience. One, because this could happen again. And he speaks about that in the very beginning of the podcast. And also because there are people that don't believe that the Holocaust happened. And he thinks it's extremely important that he can tell his story and make people believe that this, I want to say tragedy, beyond tragedy,
atrocity
yeah. took place. I think the thing that struck me the most about Tommy, and it's actually stayed with me for days and days and days, was, I think, Venetia, you asked him something about empathy for people who have lost someone in smaller circumstances than the ones he's been in. And he's actually overflowing with empathy for people who have all kinds of different loss. Even he was talking about the families in California whose houses burned down and how that made him cry. It hasn't hardened him.
I find that fascinating because sometimes I think about, somebody was talking about something the other day and I went, I felt hardened to it. But still, it's only a building. I didn't feel the same devastation they were feeling.
Yeah.
But he's such an incredible person because just even the way he fears for our future, the way he talks about his grandmother and his family members, and it's like as if it was yesterday for him.
Yeah, he has such a, I mean, and It's hard to imagine ever being in anything like a circumstance like that at all. Tommy was just about to head off to meet some people because he is being honoured. The Bar of Ireland Human Rights Award will be presented to him on the 28th of November, which he so rightly deserves.
And he's so thrilled.
So thrilled, which was amazing. And we didn't get to talk about it very much, but Tommy's also featured in an extraordinary 2017 documentary called Condemned to Remember, and all the details of his life pre and post war in that. We mentioned that there's multiple books. There's so much to learn from him. I think you and I wanted to talk to him for hours and hours, but he's a very busy man.
He is, but he's well able to talk.
He is.
As you'll find out.
All we can say is thanks for giving us his time.
Today is a truly special episode of the podcast as we're joined in studio by Tommy Reichenthal, whose personal story is inspirational, it's emotional, but more than all, a story that's incredibly important to tell. Tommy, first of all, you're very welcome. And
good morning.
I think both Sasha and I would like to say thank you for coming
very much
in.
So.
And thank you for having me, of course.
You're welcome. You're one of the only Holocaust survivors to have settled in Ireland after being liberated from Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in 1945. In 2019, how does that part of your life seem to you now?
Well, unfortunately, at the moment, when we look around what is happening in Europe and other places, I'm looking at it as a repeat of the history. Mm. Because in the late 1930s, when the Jews wanted to escape Europe with the fascism, the Nazis were coming to power, and they were good sign that not for the Jewish people the future is not very bright. Nobody wanted them. And today we see something similar, which is happening with the refugees, and they looking for sanctuary because they also escaping persecution, rape, murder, and nobody wants them either. So for me, this is now very important when I'm speaking about the Holocaust, especially to young people, to teach them. We have to be very careful. The history doesn't repeat itself. It only needs somebody mad again, and they can incite population. And unfortunately, which is very sad, we're seeing it here in Ireland. Just lately, people openly were marching on the street and refusing. And there was a couple here, as you know, and that had to have to go to London because they got so much abuse and threats against the children. So I think today, teaching the young generation about the Holocaust is so important, more than ever before. And that's why it's for me it's very important that as many people hear my story, and I'm delighted that you invited me, because the media is, of course, the best way to spread the message. And when people see something like this, when they see bullying, racism, they shouldn't become bystanders. They should say loudly and clearly, we don't want this. We have to stop this. Because Holocaust did not start with gas chamber. Holocaust started with whisper, first persecution, and finally murder.
You know, you say at the end of the book, people were asking why. So many people, why did this happen? And the answer was hate. Like, this did happen. Like,
well, it's something, not only end of the book I'm saying it, but I made three documentary films. And in one of the films, we were in Bergen-Belsen, and I'm standing there and looking through this huge window facing the where the camp stood. And I ask myself, why? I haven't got the answer. And I don't think, you know, there are many answers, but there are no answers. Antisemitism today exists as it always existed, and it's growing. So why? I just can't understand. I mean, in the past, for example, in my own country, I was born in Slovakia. They blamed the Jews for everything that was going wrong, you know, about 90,000 Jews living in Slovakia. Today, there are just 300. They still want to blame the Jews for what happened. Why is there anti-Semitism? Mm. What are we doing that people hate the Jews? Mm. I can't, still today, I can understand most of the people that hate Jews never met a Jew, never mind to hating them. And yet they spreading this false beliefs, where they get it, why they get it, where they learn this. It puzzles me still.
You were talking there a few minutes ago at the start, and then going back to Bergen-Belsen. Where did your story start? Where did this journey of hardship and grief and destruction of your life start?
Well, it started in my childhood in Slovakia. Of course, in Slovakia, the first laws, racial laws, which were introduced in Slovakia was in 1939, and it was the Jewish Codex. Mm. It had 270 paragraphs restricting the Jews in various ways. I can mention several of them. First of all, we had to wear a yellow star on the left side from the age of five. Whenever we got out of the house, we were not allowed to go to national school. We were not allowed to go to public places like cinema, theater, swimming pool, public park. We were not allowed to work. We were sacked from jobs. Even silly restriction like we were not allowed to cycle, we were not allowed to drive a car, we had to be at certain time in the evening in our houses. A lot of silly restriction, but there were also restriction like people that had money in the bank, they were only able to take so much per week or per month, and then with time they reduced it till they made us dependent on the state, and then they were shouting, we have to support these people. They are parasites in our country. They're not working because they were sacked for job. They created the misery, and then they blamed us for this. But of course, I didn't know anything about this. I was only a little boy, 4 or 5 years old. But as the time went on, as I said, that these laws were introduced in 1941 in September, and I started at the time school in the village, but it was a national school, so I was kicked out. I didn't even know why. Mm. I was kicked out of the school, and I had to go to the neighboring town. Now, in the village, I didn't know about anything what was happening to the Jewish people, for the simple reason that parents didn't tell me what they're going to tell 5-6-year-old boy that we are persecuted. So they kept it from me. I didn't know the children, the village children, they played with me. I didn't feel any discrimination. I didn't wear the yellow star because everybody knew us, and there was no police to enforce the law. But when I come to the town, of course, and there were several Jewish schools, there was quite a large Jewish community. Everybody had to wear the yellow star because police was all around, and if the Jewish people come out of the area and didn't wear the yellow star, they would have been arrested, punished very severely. And I remember at the time my aunt was sewing the star, and I said, what is that for? And she said, it's nothing. We are Jewish. We have to wear the yellow star. And I didn't even ask why, you know. The innocence at the time. Today, a six-year-old here in Ireland not only knows what is happening in Ireland, they know what is happening all over the world, you know. They can tell you a plane fell in America or something, some tragedy happened. They come home and they tell you about it. I didn't know what was happening beyond the village, you know. Yeah. We didn't know about these things. We didn't have any television or internet or anything like that. When I went to school, in the first 2 or 3 days, my aunt would come with me, and the school, because the Jewish people lived in certain parts of the community hall, the school, the synagogue was very near. I think the school was about 300 yards from where we lived. So she came with me 2 or 3 times. I was 6 years old at the time. And she said, you know where the school is. You can go on your own. And that was the day that I discovered that I'm different to other children because I had the yellow star. And when children were standing on a corner of the street without the yellow star, obviously Gentile, they started to shout at me, you dirty Jew, you smelly Jew, go to Palestine, and all kind of insult that I can't even mention. And that went for me. It started as the time went on. They were more aggressive. They would try to spit at me and throw a stone after me. I used to run to the school, and when I saw children on the left side, I would run to the right side so that they don't catch me.
Were you
but
scared?
They did. They're scared.
You
I was
must
scared.
Have been very scared.
And, I used to come home to my aunt. I don't want to go to school. I'm being abused on the way and everything. So that was the start when I realized I'm different to the other people. I couldn't understand, why do they hate me? What did I do? I never harmed anybody.
So you and your family ended up in Bergen-Belsen. Yeah. How many members of your family were there, and how many did you lose?
There were two phases of deportation from Slovakia, because Slovakia was an independent state, but it was very sympathetic to the Nazi regime in Germany, while rest of Europe, like France, Belgium, Holland, and all the rest of Europe was being occupied by German army. Slovakia, in fact, was not occupied because there was a lot of cooperation between the countries. When the war broke out, Slovakia was very useful to the Germans because it broke out, of course, on the Polish border. So through Slovakia, they would transport the manpower, the ammunition, the heavy equipment, the tank and guns from Germany to the Polish border. The deportation started from Slovakia March 1942. During this time, Slovakia had altogether between 85 to 90,000 Jews. But during this first phase, about 58,000 were deported out of the 90,000. According to the statistic, only between 280 and 500 survived. Rest of them all perished in the Holocaust. During this time, about 30 members of my family were taken away. These were uncle, aunt, my grandparents from my father's side, cousin that I knew. They used to come to their annual holiday to the village. We used to play. I knew them all. Also, the uncle and aunt. These people, I knew them, even though I was only a little boy. And we still in the family. Well, there are not many now left of us. My cousin that was with me in the concentration camp, she died this year. So there is only my brother and myself that, thank God, we're still doing well. But we still speak about these people like we know them, we like they are among us. One day we said goodbye to them. Sometimes we didn't even cry, just said, everything will be all right. When it's all over, we will be reunited. But we never saw them again.
How do you grieve for somebody when you say goodbye to somebody and then you don't know if you're ever going to see them again?
Well, at the time, we didn't know. I mean, it took very long time till actually we found out, not myself, kids, we didn't because we were not told, but the adult among us, it took long time because in the cinema there was propaganda showing the Jews walking and doing their laundry, playing football and sport, and they said they're doing very well, and we believed it. But when they were taken away, it was only a matter of couple of days, they were gone. And not only this, these people had opportunity to write a postcard, and many of them were told put the date in months advance, you know. And there was a very clever way how these people send the message what is happening, because we didn't know. And they would write, I'm going to see my grandfather tomorrow and we will be reunited. Now the people home suddenly said, grandfather, he's dead for the last 20 years. And she said, we will be reunited. So Piton, there were all kinds of ways. Signal light, and people began to realize what they're trying to say, that tomorrow we are going to be killed, we will be reunited with the dead. But at the time, we were not taken away because specifically people that were not useful to the Slovak economy were being arrested. And that was done not by German, because Slovakia was not occupied by Germany. That was done by the Slovak police. And then they were passed to the German. And of course, German exterminated them. And at the time, we didn't know. But because my father was a farmer, he was useful to the economy, and therefore we got a document that for the time being we shouldn't be taken away. And that's why we were not taken away in this first phase. But then on the 29th of August 1944, there was an uprising in Slovakia because people hated the regime there. Slovak people as well suffered under this regime. Anybody that didn't belong to the party was discriminated against. Anybody that spread any rumor against the government was arrested, sometimes never seen again. So people hated the Slovak regime. They hated Joseph Tiso, who was the president. He was actually a priest, that what he was doing. And therefore, the uprising, many soldiers joined the uprising, police joined the uprising. So Tiso had no power to suppress this uprising. And that's why in August 1944, for the first time, the German army occupied Slovakia. Not because they wanted to occupy the country, but because they wanted to save their friendly Tiso regime, which they of course succeeded. And unfortunately, after the uprising, which lasted about 3 weeks, thousands of Slovak young men and women died in this uprising. Unfortunately, with the German army units of Adolf Eichmann arrived. Adolf Eichmann, you might know, he was the man that organized the transport to the extermination camp. It was the Gestapo. And we knew that no document will help us now. And we decided to leave the village, because even though most of them, they were good people, but police and the Gestapo got together, they become very efficient. They put spies in villages and town to spy on the remaining 25,000-30,000 Jews that were still in Slovakia. And it was only a matter of time that somebody will betray us. So the decision was made that we leave the village and we go to live in another place where nobody knew us, pretending that we were Gentiles. It was actually a priest in the village who was a very good man that provided us with false paper and even taught us, my brother and myself, a little bit about the Catholic religion, how to pray, and the prayers in the school we had to learn, how to cross ourselves, how to make a grace about the station on the cross, and all these little things, the holidays in the Catholic calendar. At the time, if somebody would have reported on him, what he was doing, that he was teaching us, and that he gave us a false paper, he wouldn't have been put on trial or anything. He would have been put to the wall and shot. I mean, it was such a crime. So it was very heroic of this priest to do what he did for us. In actual fact, I went to Slovakia about 40 years later. He died in 1967. And I went to the grave, and in my own way, I thanked him what he did for us, even though in the end it didn't save us. But he did it. It was such a heroic thing. So anyway, unfortunately, with all our false document and everything, first of all, my father was betrayed by a local man and was taken away. We were still in Bratislava and we suddenly got a postcard from my father. There were four words: I'm alive, don't worry. We didn't know where it came from, what happened to him, but thankfully he did survive. After the war, we were reunited. We thought we will never see him again. He, of course, thought he will not see us again.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion, and empathy for those grieving.
How long was it between when you saw him? How long was the...
Only several days, maybe a week, 2 weeks. We were betrayed as well in Bratislava. We were arrested by the Gestapo and then taken to detention camp in Slovakia, where we stood for selection. I don't know if you know what happened at this selection. It was a very cruel way how families were separated. I remember it was on the 2nd of November 1944 that we were called on a roll call. There were about 300 odd people, and family by family were called from of this high-ranking officer. His name was Alois Brunner. He escaped after the war to Syria, and Syria kept him because of the situation in the Middle East. The German wanted to put him on trial for crime against humanity. They didn't succeed. So he lived out his life. He died in year 2000. But he was a god that decided who is going to live and who is going to die. At the time, there were 13 of us arrested, all family members, my aunt, uncle, two cousins, my grandmother. We were 13. We came in front of the Alois Brunner. 7 went to the right, and 6 of us, which was my grandmother, my aunt, one of my cousins, my mother, my brother, and myself, to the left. And at the time, we knew exactly, not again, I didn't know, I wasn't told, but the adult among us knew exactly what that meant. The people on the left, old people, children, mother, they were destined for the gas chamber. The 7 that went to the other side, they had a chance to survive. They would be working, and maybe they will be lucky. But as it happened, I think one aunt went to Sachsenhausen and 6 to Buchenwald. Buchenwald was a slave labor camp. The inmate works in a stone quarry in freezing cold. This was November, December, January, with very little food, 12-hour-a-day shift, disease. The life expectancy in Buchenwald was between 2 to 3 months. So unfortunately, out of the seven, only one person survived. Mm. It was my cousin. He was 15 years old. Mm. I remember when my aunt was separated from her husband. She had no time to kiss him goodbye or anything. He went to one side. She came to other side. We waved to our uncle and thing. When it's all over, we will be reunited. That was the last time we saw them. But we went to Bergen-Belsen, and we were destined to go to Auschwitz. That's for the mother, children, and old people from Slovakia went straight to Auschwitz. But as it happened, the gas chamber in Auschwitz were blown up by the German on the 7th of November 1944. We were actually on the train. And at the time, we were traveling 7 days because they didn't know what to do with us. There was no point to take us to Auschwitz because there were no more gas chamber. So we were diverted to Bergen-Belsen. This was the first transport from Slovakia that didn't go to Auschwitz with children and old people. Mm. If I was arrested a week earlier, I wouldn't be speaking to you here. So, miracle. Mm. You can't call it anything else.
You know, you're talking about what they portrayed it was like for people. What was it really like? So when you did get to Bergen-Belsen...
Well, the only way to describe it, when we came to Bergen-Belsen, it was hell on earth. It's very difficult for an ordinary person to understand. When you come out the next morning, I remember we were exhausted and everything. And as we were going to the to Bergen-Belsen, we were marching for 2.5 hours. And suddenly, after 2.5 hours, we see this chimney with glow coming out. My mother and all the adults thought, that's it. This is the last minute, last hour that we're walking on this earth. She was sure that we didn't know. And I only remember that my mother squeezed my brother and myself to the body. It was so distinct because what must have gone in her head at the thing when she saw this glow coming from the chimney. But in fact, Bergen-Belsen was not extermination camp. It was a detention camp. But people were dying there for starvation, disease, cold. The conditions were unbearable. It was one of the worst camps in the Second World War. It was absolute hell. I met a witness that stood at a trial in Bergen-Belsen after the war. And she get testimony. She was in Auschwitz and she was brought to Bergen-Belsen. And I asked her what it was like coming from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen. He said, well, Auschwitz was an extermination camp. Well over 1 million people died. We knew what was happening. We had enough food. We were fed. We were working. It was bearable. Who survived was bearable. But when we come to Bergen-Belsen, it was hell on earth. Because Bergen-Belsen was detention camp, yet people were dying from starvation, disease, cold. Our intake of food was a little over 600 calories. I mean, we live adult today on 2,500 to 3,500 calories. We ate only 600 calories. That's not sufficient to sustain you alive. And this is why when you see archive film and you see all these skeletons, that's why they were skeleton, because we were starving. First of all, when you come there and our food was 2 slices of bread and coffee in the morning. On lunch, we got turnips. They were cut to little square and boiled in water. And in the evening, 2 slices of bread and coffee again. That was the menu every day. There was no change in the menu. And you had to live in it. So when you come First you become hungry, and after hunger comes the starvation. When you're starving, the body eats itself from inside till you're getting skinnier and skinnier. Then you become like a skeleton. But when I say skeleton, you can see every bone. It's only skin and bone. And you eventually die. Over 70,000 people perished in Bergen-Belsen. And we lost our grandmother, the tragedy which happened on the 7th of March, 1945. One morning, I remember, I saw my mother and my aunt. They were crying, and I said, "Why are you crying?" And they said, "My grandmother died." I mean, we sat there. This Sonderkommando, which is the special commando, these were men that come from the men camp with the cart, with two wheels, and they would come in and they would pick up the dead bodies that usually went to the crematoria and so the crematoria was there to burn the dead body for the obvious reason. The German thought from the beginning they will win the war. So after the war, they can say nobody died in Bergen-Belsen because there was no graves or graveyard. They burned the body. But eventually, so many people were dying that the crematoria couldn't cope. The bodies were thrown all around. As children, we used to play among the dead corpses. These corpses were decomposing and rotting away. But that was our area. Kids, we had to go out. We played hide and seek. We didn't hide behind trees and wall. We hid behind dead corpses. Now, I can't describe what we saw front of us. These corpses were decomposing and rotting away. So it was on the 7th of March that this Sonderkommando came to our room. They picked my grandmother, they stripped her, so she was just like a little baby, just skin and bone. The skin was just hanging from her. And one picked her by her leg, one by hand. She was thrown onto the cart, wheeled outside, and thrown on the pile of corpses. Imagine my grandmother. She told me stories. She baked the best cake for me. And I'm sitting there as a kid. I was nearly 10. And all this played front of me. And I, of course, will take this memory with me when I'm gone. I never will forget it.
When you see people dying, loads of people we've talked to on this podcast, they might have lost one or two. I think it's two at most, family members. And you can't compute that. That's hard to compute. When you see death and murder, actually, on such a wide scale, how does that change how you grieve? Are you angry? Do you become numb to the grief?
It would be more or less... I mean, I'm very emotional, you know. When look, lately, Gay Byrne went, and you know... I know him, so I met him and I had beautiful picture with him. And the emotion will come, even if it was a stranger, that he contributed so much to our well-being here in Ireland. And I used to watch his programs and eventually I met him. I can't say I'm numb to it, you know, but it is the emotion. It's even other things would bring me to tears when I see people suffering so much. You know, when you see families, even though in America, which is a prosperous country and everything, and when you see these fires in California and the woman would stand and front of her house is gone. It might have cost million, but it doesn't mean anything. And she's in tears and it touches
me.
You know, it's imagine how lucky we are that we don't even realize this. These people had life and thing, and in one instance, all is gone. They haven't got even a photograph of their family. Yeah. It's all gone.
It took you a long time to talk about this. You haven't talked about this as you went along for your whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
It took you a long time to decide that this was something. How do you feel now that you are able to talk about it and get it out there to so many more people?
Well, I didn't speak about it for 55 years. My wife died in 2003. She had a cancer. And she died not knowing what happened to me. I never told her. I never told my children. And they found out from newspaper and from the books that I wrote. I still didn't take them and sat them and told them what I meant. They probably will hear this interview. And this is how they learned about what happened to me. So I just couldn't speak about it. But eventually I came to the realization that I owe it to the victims. I lost 35 members of my family. I owe it to the victims that their memory is not forgotten. And also, I'm one of the last witnesses to this horrific event. We have people today that trying to deny that the Holocaust didn't exist. The Holocaust did exist. I was there. I went through with it. And that's why when I'm speaking and I have the opportunity like now to say it, Holocaust did happen. That's all lies, all these people that are trying to say it didn't happen. I saw thousands and thousands of bodies lying around and I played among these corpses. It did happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have to speak. Till I can speak, I will. So even though I didn't speak for 55 years, now they can't stop me.
Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.